on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 88-year-old Sherman Kishi of Livingston, California. As a teenager, he was one of more than 110,000 Japanese Americans uprooted from their West Coast homes and forced into relocation camps for what at the time was really indefinite incarceration. Where was the camp that your family was sent to?
All of this area was sent to Amachi, Colorado. Camp Amachi, it was called. It's right at Grenada, Colorado, which is in the southeastern corner of Colorado.
And what was life like there?
Like every other camp, it was in the most desolate place that they could find. Really, I think it was the most desolate place that they could find in Colorado. And they had trouble finding places for these camps. We know that it was cold in the winter. It was dusty because almost all the camps were made by dozing off the sagebrush wherever it may be. That was included Topaz, included Heart Mountain. All the camps were the same, and all the Arizona camps were all the same. One of the most violent and worst thing that we remember is the dust storms that we used to have because they were so bad. But we all lived through that, eventually made the relocation camps a livable place. They planted trees and planted gardens, and things changed in those camps.
And how did it come about that you decided to go fight for the country that was holding your family hostage?
In 1942, after 9066, there was still a draft going on, of course, and they changed the status of all people of Japanese ancestry from a 1A status to a 4C status, which was an enemy alien status. So we were no longer eligible for the draft. So in 1942 and 43, I finished my high school. And during that period of time, they came in to recruit for the 442nd. And I was not 17 yet, so I couldn't get into the service at that stage. But just before I graduated, they also came in to recruit for MIS. And I studied a little bit of Japanese in the camp. I had a very, very smattering of Japanese in the community before the war, but very little. And so I studied a little bit in camp, learned a little bit of the alphabet, basically. And when they came in, they accepted me. I had talked to my father about this, and I told him that I wanted to go. And he said, "This is your country. You go right ahead and do what you think is best." So my father approved my going as well.
And did your brother go in before or after you?
No, my brother is 4 years older than I am, but he had been going to University of California before the war. And my father became sick in 1941, and so he had to come back and help run the farm. And of course the war happened, and so we all went to the camps. And as soon as he was able, he went to go back to college to try to finish his college. And he went back to Maryland, University of Maryland, and was enrolled there, and was going to school there. And the draft began in 1944. And I had volunteered into the service and got into the service in November of 1943. So I was in before he got in. He got drafted shortly after the draft began. So he came in 1944 into the service.
Yeah, once they took so many casualties overseas, they realized they could draft the people they had declared as enemy aliens after all, huh?
Well, I guess that's what happened. By then, you know, the 100th Battalion that came out of Fresno had done a tremendous job in Italy, and they needed lots of replacements. When they came in to recruit for the 442, which the 100th became part of, there were many of them that joined at that time. Most of the people that joined when they first came in to recruit were volunteers, but later they were drafted and put into the service, and most of them went into the 442.
And that 442nd Regimental Combat Team, of course, is legendary for its courage, its bravery, the amount of decorations per capita blows everything else away in World War II. And you mentioned you were too young to join the 442 when they came through. Had you been old enough, do you think you would have?
I probably would have, yes, because I had many friends that did. So, yeah, I probably would have joined if I was old enough.
You had many friends that joined. How many of those friends came home?
In our small community, we lost three in Italy and France. And so that's a pretty good percentage of young men that we lost in Europe with the 442.
Have you ever thought about that? That had you been able to join the 442nd and went over there, whether or not you would have survived?
Oh, yeah. I've thought about that many times. But I had a brother-in-law married to my youngest sister. That's before he's married. He was in the service and was sent over there. but he survived through all the battles, and he was a company runner. And a company runner's job was the communication between the front lines and the company. So he was in a very dangerous position, but he survived without a scratch through all that. And so you never know, you know, when that happens, it just happens. So you can't tell what's going to happen.
No, you can't. And, of course, you didn't serve in the 442nd, but I imagine you still take some pride in what those people who were facing similar circumstances as you were did accomplish. When you hear someone talk about today that phrase, go for broke, does it mean something to you? And if so, what?
That phrase means a lot. That means you do everything that you possibly can to do whatever you're doing. The young men that were my friends who were in MIS, there were a number of them killed as well in the Pacific. And they did a tremendous job over there. I had a good friend that ended up in Burma as part of the Mero Marauders. And he went through that campaign, and he survived through it. There was a lot of things that happened in the Pacific as well as in the 442 in Europe.
Well, and I want to hear about what you did. And some folks might not know what MIS stands for. That's Military Intelligence Service?
That's correct. Yeah, Military Intelligence Service is what we were in. You know, when I got out of school, I had to go to basic training after that, after I learned my Japanese. And so by the time I was eligible to go overseas, it was starting to get a little late in the war. And I was ready in 1945, finally, after basic training and after my training. I went through a 9-month program of learning Japanese.
Was that hard for you?
Oh, was that ever hard? Can you imagine getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting ready for reveille and all that, and then going to class at 8 o'clock, staying in class until 4 o'clock, and then having your military things after that. And then we went back to classes at 7 o'clock at night, and we stayed there until at least 9. Wow. And so we had all that time to learn the Japanese language, and it was not easy, and we didn't have enough time. So we used to put flashlights under the blanket. We used to go to the latrine, where there's light, and we used to study so we could learn enough to get by. Yeah, it was the toughest schooling that I ever went through.
I know you lived it, and it's easy to maybe in retrospect not read too much into it. But I think a lot of people that didn't go through what you went through think, where do you find the motivation to put in that kind of effort, again, for a government, for a country that is holding your family prisoner, is, you know, that you've had to move away from the land that you've had your entire life, and here they are in this internment camp. How did you get past that mentally and emotionally, and how would you describe the mindset you did have?
You know, I didn't think about that very much, frankly. This was our country. This is the only country that we knew, and this is the only country we're loyal to. All we thought about was doing what we needed to do for our own country. We knew that Japan, our folks came from Japan, but that really didn't cut any ice with us, because we never knew any of those people over there. And so they became our enemies, basically.
And that attitude you described, did you feel like that was pretty common among the other men that you were training with?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Although you have to realize that when we went to the MIS, there were many young men who were called Kibes. And Kibe means a young person of the ancestry who were sent back as citizens from the United States to Japan to be educated. And so there were many of those people that were in MIS. And some of them had some completely different feelings about it. There were some of the Kibes who were very hopeful that Japan would win. But basically, they were very loyal to the United States. And most of the translating and interpreting that was done in the Pacific was basically done by the Kibes. The Niseis were not very strong in Japanese, and so they did most of the English writing that had to be done on the reports and things. And so you have to give a lot of credit to those young men who learned the language in Japan and came back and fought for the United States.
So after 9 months of that schooling, staying up with your flashlight to study Japanese, what happened next?
One of the interesting things about that period is that they had some classes for the Caucasian people to learn Japanese. They had a class at the University of Denver. They also had a class at University of Michigan. And this was to learn Japanese to become translated interpreters. And they went to the university, learned the language for 2 years. When they got done, they came out with bars on their shoulders. They became lieutenants. When we came out of our school after 9 months, and some of them were in 6 months class. If we were lucky, we came out with 2 stripes on our arm as corporals. So things were a little different.
Yeah.
That's sort of interesting that such a thing as that happened. After that happened, we waited for a while, and in July of 1945, I got onto a ship out of San Francisco, and I remember the Golden Gate Bridge going away, wove our way back and forth across the Pacific. It took us a whole month to get to the Philippines. I was, along with many other the young men, were put into what they call ADIS, which is Allied Translating and Interpreting Section. This is of MIS. There's a racetrack right out of Manila, and that's where we were stationed. And we did some translating and things while we're there. I was there for about a month, and of course the war ended in August. By the middle of August, it was all done. And Japan had surrendered. And so shortly thereafter, they sent us into Japan as part of the occupation forces. And we were in Japan in September of 1945 as part of the occupation force. And one of the things that I remember about that so vividly is when we got into Yokohama and embarked there, they still had a few trains running. And so they put us on a train to go into Tokyo. And we were sent into the finance building in Tokyo, the federal finance building there, as a billet. And all the way from Yokohama to Tokyo, which is about 20 miles, it was nothing but black. The incendiary bomb that the United States had dropped was so effective that that whole 20-mile section was completely devastated. And I remember that very clearly.
How hard was that to see, just as a human being, to realize the impact of that bombing? What was that like for you as a young man to look out the window of that train and see that?
Yeah, it was total devastation, it was. But you know what I thought about? I was in the Philippines, and the Philippines had been bombed as well, of course, you know. And so the city of Manila, we went in there when we had some time off, and there was nothing done to improve any of the devastation there. There was stuff scattered on the sidewalks and into the streets and all that, and it was still a mess. When we went to Japan, in spite of the fact that everything was black, there were people with wheelbarrows cleaning up any debris that was there. So I thought, oh my goodness, what a difference in the attitude of people. And I always wondered why, but I think what happened was that's the difference of people's energy within a subtropical or tropical area versus a area where the climate is so much nicer. And I really think that's what makes those people do what they did in Japan.
Having just come back from a football game in Hawaii last week, I guess I can back that up, because things do tend to go a little more slowly in those tropical locales. You mentioned the war coming to an end. Do you remember where you were and how you heard that Japan had surrendered and what that meant to you at the time?
We were in the camp in Manila at the racetrack. And when we heard that the surrender had happened, we were very gleeful, of course, that that had happened. We knew that there would be no more war. And so we were, I don't exactly remember the celebration that we had. That was fine, but even in spite of that, you know, there was still fighting going on in the Philippines, and there were occasional bodies that came floating down the river that was right next to the camp there. So we didn't think that much of the change that was going to happen, but it did change tremendously very shortly.
Being there in Japan as part of the occupation forces, I imagine at some point you interacted with the Japanese people. What was that like? I'm sure there are a couple things that stand out about those interactions.
People were fearful that the Japanese people were going to resist them considerably. Those of us who were translators and interpreters who were in MIS, we spoke the language. And we just looked just like the people that were there. And so they accepted us very quickly. And we became very friendly with people very quickly. And we visited different families there and actually had a good time while we're there, really, in spite of the fact that we were the conquerors. So we just sort of somewhat felt like we came home, I guess. I remember before I came home, I took a furlough, took 10 days off. And I went to visit my relatives who had never seen before and never been near. And they were in the city of Wakayama, which is quite a ways from Tokyo. It's about a 4-hour trip on the train. The one feeling that I had when I got there to my father's family home and with the people that I knew nothing about was that I felt like I went home. It was an amazing feeling that such a thing happened, but it did. I really did feel like I went home.
So they must have treated you pretty well, and I guess without the war, maybe that never would have happened?
Probably not, but I remember how things were so bad in Tokyo. People had no food. I remember young girls with rucksacks that used to go out to the country with all their whatever belongings they had that they could trade, took them out to the country and traded for sweet potatoes and brought them back so the family could eat. Our families in Wakayama were no better off. They were very poor. I remember filling my duffel bag as full as I could with everything that I could, and I took it with me when I went down there and distributed it to these people. 30 years later, when we went to visit, they were kids at the time. They still talked about it. It's amazing.
That is really something. What a unique perspective you have on all of this. And we're going to get more of that perspective from Sherman Kishi. If you want to see how youthful this 88-year-old golf and tennis player remains, well, I know you hear it in his voice too, but you can find photos on Facebook. Just type in Hometown Heroes Radio. Back with the rest of Mr. Kishi's story right after this.